This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. In 1971, Jon Kabat-Zinn finished his PhD in the laboratory of Nobel laureate Salvador Luria at MIT, and then he took what might be considered a left turn. He went to study with Buddhist masters. Several years later, he drew on both his training in biology and Buddhism when he created the first rigorous course in mindfulness-based stress reduction. Some 40 years later, mindfulness has become something of a movement, with practitioners applying the idea to everything from stress reduction to corporate leadership and parenting, even disease prevention and, in some cases, treatment. And mindfulness is increasingly being taught in schools to improve students' performance and help kids cope with stress, both academic and at home. But not everyone is on board. Earlier this year, efforts to introduce a mindfulness-based stress reduction course in the Dennis Yarmouth School District met with pushback. Those objecting to the course cited religious beliefs and concerns about potential negative effects of mindfulness training. We here at Living Lab started wondering, just what is the science behind mindfulness? So for answers, we turn to Jon Kabat-Zinn himself. He's founding executive director of the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's also the founding director of its renowned stress reduction clinic and professor emeritus of medicine. He's the author of 6 books on mindfulness, and he teaches mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction in venues around the world. He joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Jon, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. It's nice to be here.
What made you, a molecular biologist by training, think that Buddhism was something that you should go study?
Well, when you read these kinds of narratives about your own life, you can't help recognizing that they are very partial and slanted in a certain way. So it seems like, wow, what a gigantic shift from molecular biology to Buddhist meditative practices. But it wasn't so much of a shift for me because ever since I was very young, I was interested in questions having to do with consciousness and how it evolved and, you know, the biology of consciousness and so forth. So I went into molecular biology really interested in these deep questions about what fundamentally makes us human from the beginning. And at a certain point, after I got exposed at MIT to Zen meditation practice from a fellow named Philip Kaplow, who wrote a book called The Three Pillars of Zen back in the mid-60s, I realized this is another door into exactly what I was looking for from the scientific perspective. That is, to begin to study oneself, to pay attention to one's own experience from a more stepped back perspective a little bit and see how one's own mind works and how it's driven. And in certain ways, that then complements what we can study from an outside perspective as a scientist. So there's a terminology for this in the scientific world now, and that's called first-person experience versus third-person experience. First-person experience is what used to be called pejoratively subjective experience, where it's just like what you think or what you feel, and we can't have any, you know, sort of real purchase over that scientifically. But now there are methods for actually looking at that and then correlating it with what's going on in the brain and in other parts of the body through methodologies that weren't available, technologies that weren't available in the late 70s when I started the mindfulness-based stress reduction program.
As you say, at this point, we are starting to understand this almost philosophical practice at a molecular level, and we'll talk about that science more in a little bit. But as you also just said, we didn't really have the tools to even do that in the 70s. Did you ever question whether it was possible or feasible to really combine these two?
Well, my intuition was that people are actually starving for what mindfulness offers. So let me just define it for your listening audience. You know, to a first approximation, mindfulness is simply awareness, or you could think of it as pure awareness. And that's differentiating it from thinking. And in schools, for instance, since you mentioned what was going on in the public schools on the Cape, in schools, for instance, there's tons of training in thinking and how to be a better thinker and a more analytical thinker and a more synthetic thinker and interrogate particular kinds of problems and solve them through thought. but there's almost no training in another equally powerful, if not more powerful, capacity we're born with, and that is for holding things in awareness that's much bigger than mere cognition or conceptualizing. There's, you know, the awareness that knows the body, for instance. We often call that the wisdom of the body, but no training in that whatsoever. There's the awareness of how one's feeling emotionally in the body and in one's own heart, so to speak.
Which we now have this term, emotional intelligence.
Exactly.
But tends not to come up until you get into leadership training somewhere later in your career.
Well, exactly. And that was actually developed, that perspective was developed through research at Yale. And then Dan Goleman wrote the book, Emotional Intelligence, in 1995 it came out. And it was like a huge international bestseller. And that really put it on the map. So there's a certain kind of evolution in our understanding of our own repertoire as human beings for what we're capable of. And this has expanded beautifully. And you're absolutely right that I don't think mindfulness would be anywhere near as popular as it is now, and as much at the core of much of medical and psychological practice as it is now, if it weren't for the science. So the scientific results and study and results of mindfulness-based programs have actually driven the interest in it, because once people feel like, well, the science says that this is real, that's very different from, you know, sort of meditating with your eyes closed and all of the images that would sort of popularly come to mind about how weird that might be, or how, you know, sort of culturally contrived or imprisoned.
Well, so I'm curious, there wasn't this body of scientific research in the 70s when you started it. How did your scientific colleagues respond to what you were trying to do?
Well, Salvador Luria, for instance, who was my thesis advisor, who you mentioned, you know, thought that I'd kind of gone off the deep end or gone over to the dark side. And you know, but he was also a humanist. He was, an Italian physician who came over, you know, during the war, World War II, and then did this seminal research on mutations and how mutations are spontaneous. And he was a humanist as well as a scientist and also a doctor. And he also cut me a lot of slack. And he thought he must know what he's doing. And a lot of people actually give you that kind of slack when you have a kind of PhD from MIT. They think, oh, he must know what he's doing. You know, he's got to be smart or something like that. And of course, I didn't know what I was doing. But I was feeling my way with that intuition that came from like just being young and wanting to understand things that nobody was really looking at, and thinking that might be a really good place to find a way to understand what it means to be human in ways that were important to me, even as a young person.
How much has what you teach in mindfulness-based stress reduction changed in 40 years?
That's a really interesting question. And I guess I'll give you a kind of a Zen, non-dual answer. Not at all, and enormously. Okay? Not at all, in the sense that it's the same thing. It always is. It's like attention and awareness. And attention brought to everything in one's life in an open-hearted, spacious way. And the awareness that arises from that. On the other hand, you can't marinate in that kind of practice on a regular daily basis through formal meditation practice and bringing it into your daily life for 40 years without it changing you in certain ways. So,
well, that's the whole point. Right?
Well, in a way it is, or to actually not so much change you, but to allow you to actually be comfortable in your own skin, no matter what's going on in your life. And that would mean at times very stressful, pain conditions, illness, I mean, everything that arises as part of the human condition, how to be in wiser relationship with that so that we're not, in some sense, crushed by the eventuality of things that come our way as we grow older, as we lives get more complicated, as things speed up and so forth. So I think that mindfulness has reached a point, and let me also say this is a formal meditation practice. It's not just some concept or philosophy or good idea or catechism. It's like exercising a muscle. You have to actually exercise it in order for it to develop. And so mindfulness, let's be very clear, the more popular it gets, the less people understand. It's only the hardest thing in the world for us human beings to be mindful for even one moment, never mind stringing two moments of presence together in an open-hearted, spacious way. We have this capacity. What people don't understand is it's not a special state you try to achieve, like now I'm going to strive to get into some mindful state. It's like, no, mindfulness is like you're in some sense what the neuroscientists would call your default mode if you really have cultivated it, and that is open-hearted, spacious presence that understands, that knows in ways that go way beyond the mere conceptual, as I said. And so that's something that over time transforms how you are in relationship to everything. So you're the same old person you always were, and at the same time, every moment is new, fresh, different, and allows you to be, in some sense, I think, much more in touch with your multiple intelligences, and I underscore multiple, and also your own unique beauty as a human being. And rather than get lost in anxiety and depression and always trying to get through this moment so you get to some better moment on the weekend or when your kids grow up and get out of the house or whatever
it is. Guilty as charged often.
But to realize that it never actually gets any more magical than this, because this is the only moment we ever have. And if we can't be in wise relationship to this one, and in our body and with our breath and with our thoughts, deranged as they sometimes are, and our emotions, which are turbulent as they sometimes are, if we can't be in wise relationship to that now, what makes us think that 20 years later it will be any better than that? We'll be just sort of more frenetic in some sense, maybe feel like we're more like a victim or a prisoner of what happened to us. And so you'll just be older. You won't necessarily be any wiser or more, you know, in touch with things. So this is a practice that has wisdom built into this very moment. It's saying you're already whole, which is the root meaning of the word health, healing, and holy. So if you can make that real in this moment, which is a meaning of the word realization, if you can realize that right now in the body, and we're doing it just as we're talking. People might think, well, when do we get down to the real meditation? Talking in this way, having a conversation this way, is as much meditation as anything else, because when it comes right down to it, the real meditation practice, the real mindfulness practice, is living life in the only moment we ever have.
I was going to ask you to perhaps give us some sort of exercise or a taste of how you would practice it. Is there a way to do that in, I mean, you know, we're not going to spend the next hour meditating.
Well, we might be, only you'd have to rotate your ideas about what meditation are. In fact, we will be, I'm thinking, spending the next hour meditating in the sense that, you know, your job is to put stuff out through the airwaves and people are listening to it. And hopefully, you know, if it's interesting, as your program always is, and I listen to it a lot, it sets up resonances in one's own being, in one's own mind, but also in one's own heart and in one's own body, because meaning does that. And it shows us things that we don't already know. So if we're truly listening to the radio, to this program, or to anybody, or even to the waves coming in at the shore, if we're truly listening, that's a moment of mindful presence. So we could easily spend the entire time that we have together meditating if you understand mindfulness as simply being appropriately present to what's unfolding in this moment. So that said, I'm aware that a lot of your listeners are probably in the car driving around and so already splitting their attention. So rather than doing things, you know, like ringing bells. And
we're not going to have everybody stop and sit and close their eyes.
No, exactly. Pull over to the side of the road and test this out. It occurred to me that driving itself is a form of mindfulness, or hopefully it's a form of mindfulness. There are far too many automobile accidents. But, you know, when you are really not just staring through the windshield, but actually apprehending what's coming in front of you through your windshield and also aware of the side mirrors and the rear view mirror in a certain way, you are in the present moment. And then something comes up, like you see something, maybe it's a tow truck, maybe it's a cow, and your attention gets captured and you want to follow the tow truck, but you're going 60 or 70 miles an hour. You can't afford to turn your head and follow the cow or the tow truck.
That actually seems like
you have
a great
to bring
metaphor.
Your attention back to what's right in front of the windshield.
And that seems like a great metaphor, actually, for modern day life, that we're all going at 60 or 70 miles an hour all the time.
Very true.
And we can't get distracted. We have to keep our focus on
very
on
true.
What's
and
right
you know,
moment.
But when you do that, you discover that the now also has a timeless quality to it. So you might be looking at your watch and saying, I'm already late. I got to get there. And you start putting your foot on the gas and so forth. But you're not late. You're here, wherever that is. You're exactly where you are now. And when you get to where you're going, then you'll be there. And you could call it late. But the fact is, it's not going to help if you speed up and, you know, kill somebody or have an accident or something like that, because your concept of late makes you a little bit crazy or stressed.
How is mindfulness different from relaxation?
Okay. I like to say that mindfulness is not relaxation spelled differently. For one thing, relaxation is a kind of state of mind and body that when you're experiencing it, you feel completely at home and relaxed, okay? And when you don't experience it, you think you've failed in some way. If you're trying to do a relaxation exercise and you're not relaxed at the end, you'll feel, oh, either there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with the exercise or there's something wrong with the person who is leading the exercise.
So, in fact, feeling stressed could be part of mindfulness?
You got it. Yeah. It's like I say to people often that we're going to teach you how to be so relaxed it's okay to be tense. Can you feel what that does? It expands the number of dimensions with which we have to work that allow us to be in wise relationship with the fact that this might be a very stressful, time-pressured moment. And if you're in the sort of media business, of course, you have lots of stressful, time-pressured moments. But how you are in relationship to them, there you have a lot of freedom. You have a lot of control. So you can be relaxed in situations, and in fact, you need to, in some cases, be extremely relaxed in cases where it's even life and death. And so these are kinds of mindfulness is much more than relaxation, but than what people commonly think of as relaxation. And again, if you come back to just pure awareness, you're as close as you can get through the thought mechanism, and the rest, you have to exercise the muscle.
That's Jon Kabat-Zinn. He's the creator of mindfulness-based stress reduction. I'm Heather Goldstone. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We hope that you will share your own experiences with mindfulness, and we will talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Jon Kabat-Zinn. He has spent nearly 40 years researching, teaching, and writing about the power of mindfulness to reduce stress and improve health. And those kinds of claims are now supported by a long list of scientific studies, which we will talk about in just a moment. We also want to hear your experiences with mindfulness. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Jon, you compared the exercise of meditation to other forms of physical exercise where you're exercising a muscle, making a muscle stronger. And studies have shown that meditation, mindfulness meditation, really does produce both structural and functional changes in the brain. Can you describe some of those changes?
Yeah, this is a new field in science known as neuroplasticity. When I was a graduate student, it didn't exist. The notion that the brain is actually an organ of experience. It's the most complex arrangement of matter in the known universe, with 200 billion neurons, another 200 billion glial cells in there that nobody really knows what they're doing, but they're not there by accident. I mean, this is like right inside our little old heads, you know, an infinite number of trillions of synaptic connections, and they are continually changing on the basis of our experience. And Actually, the structure of the brain has been shown to change and is often driven by repetitive experience. So learning involves neuroplastic changes, development of new neurons, new synaptic connections, and so forth. So now there's this technology, including functional magnetic resonance imaging and so forth, that allows us to look at things like what's called functional connectivity, how the actual connections are changing, stabilizing, fortifying themselves over the course of a period of time or even short periods of time meditating. Sarah Lazar and her group at the Mass General Hospital have shown that meditators tend to have thicker brains in certain regions. What's called gray matter density is increased in certain regions that have to do with, like, the hippocampus. Learning and memory is one of the major functions, emotion regulation. The cerebellum,
Probably wouldn't help me anyway to tell me the specific part
temporal,
of the brain.
A temporal parietal junction. So these are all domains of the brain that have different functions. We think we know what some of them are. Some of them have to do with perspective taking. And then there's the prefrontal cortex, the whole frontal cortical area that's involved in working memory capacity and what's called executive functioning. And so some of the changes that we see are thickening of different regions of the brain that have to do with this kind of perspective taking, navigating the complexities of life and so forth, emotional regulation, attention regulation. Also, the amygdala, which is in the threat reaction center in the centers in the brain, they get thinner with 8 weeks of MBSR. And this is, again, the work from...
So it sounds
Sarah
like
Lazar's
thicker brain would be better. So we're doing more
and
of the regulating, more decision-making,
long-term,
and less threat reaction.
Exactly. And long-term meditators have thicker brains than non-meditators over time. So the age... There's less decline in the brain over age, it seems. Now, this entire science is in its infancy, so I don't want to give you the impression we know everything about this most complex domain in the universe inside our own heads. But we're beginning to get increasing evidence that meditation practice, especially if you do it on a regular basis, is really, really good for the brain. It also turns out that another science that wasn't known 30 years ago is the field of epigenetics. It's not just the brain that's a dynamical, continually changing element of our lives and bodies, but also our genome, our chromosomes, are continually upregulating and downregulating various genes different in different cells. And then when we start to study this, it turns out that we see what are called epigenetic changes in genes that seem to be related to inflammation and to cancer, what are called proto-oncogenes. And these are downregulated in many studies of people who are practicing mindfulness. So those are two regions. The third one, everybody will be interested because it has to do with aging. You know, so people have probably heard about telomeres, which are these repeat subunits of DNA at the ends of our chromosomes. And it turns out that they degrade every time the cell divides, and they degrade faster when we're under chronic stress. So if you've ever had the thought cross your mind, wow, that experience took years off my life.
I constantly say to my kids, you're aging me faster.
Exactly.
Giving me gray hairs.
There's a certain way in which that's actually molecularly true. But the good news is that when you cultivate exercise these muscles that we're talking about with mindfulness, then actually an enzyme called telomerase rebuilds the telomeres so that they don't degrade as fast. In other words, you're slowing down the molecular cellular aging process and even maybe lengthening it. So again, I want to emphasize all of this is in its infancy, but the level of high quality research coming out of lots and lots of neuroscience labs and clinical labs all over the country and all over the world is staggering. And so that's, I think, one of the driving factors in getting people interested in this, because the new, in some sense, religion, unfortunately, is science. So people say, well, if science shows this is valuable, then... But that, too, can be hyped. So I think we have to proceed with a certain degree of caution and say, this is very, very promising. But as I say in the beginning of the revised edition of Full Catastrophe Living, which is the book I wrote on mindfulness-based stress reduction, I say right out there, close to the first page, that if there were no science of mindfulness, I'd still be practicing it. Because it gives such remarkable benefits to the quality of life that we live from moment to moment and how it affects our mental health, our emotional health, our physical health, and our sense of deep interconnectedness with the rest of the world, with other people and the planet, that even if there was no science of, like, the amygdala shrinks and the hippocampus gets thicker and so forth, I'd still be practicing because there's a certain way in which we know that inwardly, and that inner satisfaction is much more important than putting up a before and after brain scan of your experience of MBSR, so to speak.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn about the science of mindfulness, what we know about how it works to reduce stress and improve health. We want to hear how mindfulness has affected your life. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Is mindfulness being used in mainstream medicine to treat diseases?
Yes, it is. And we've been, in some sense, doing this for the past 37 years, as you're saying. By the way, I want to make sure people understand that I am no longer at the UMass Medical Center, and I'm not running the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society, and haven't been for the past 16 years, which I see as a very big success. So my colleague, Dr. Saki Santarelli, has been running it for all that time. There's a scientist there who just came a year or two ago from Yale University, named Judd Brewer, who is doing remarkable research around this functional connectivity with periods of meditation, some of it with real-time neural feedback using fMRI, which is really rather extraordinary. And it was he was featured in this CBS 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper, and he had Anderson Cooper in his lab actually doing real time. You can see
doing a brain scan while meditating.
Yes, it went well, and the signal is such from the what's called the posterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in, again, this perspective taking, that when you're trying to meditate, it goes red above the line. That's the way the whole thing is designed. You just go, wow, it's just kind of red. But the idea is to make it be blue. And the only way you can make it be blue is by getting out of your own way. And you learn that from just looking at the screen. And after a while, you're not doing anything. And this is an important piece about mindfulness. It's not a real doing. It's a moving back into the domain of being. That's what the present moment is really all about, and resting in awareness, and then letting whatever doing we have to do, including driving, come out of that wakeful being. And that's an art form. It's a skill. It's a muscle that one develops through practice.
I want to come back to this idea of treating disease. Is mindfulness being used solely as a treatment, or is it being used... I know there was one study which I would never have thought of psoriasis as a potential, yeah, you know, target for using mindfulness, but where mindfulness was shown to, mindfulness training was shown to actually make traditional medical psoriasis treatments
I'm
more
glad
effective.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something that came out of a conversation I had with our colleagues in the Department of Dermatology who were doing this phototherapy treatment for people with psoriasis. And stress, of course, makes the psoriasis much worse. And the treatment for it, at that time at least, was ultraviolet light therapy. It's not a cure, but if you are exposed to ultraviolet light in a way that doesn't burn the skin over time, the psoriasis actually, the skin clears, it heals. The way they do that is in a phototherapy light box where you're surrounded by these light bulbs that give off ultraviolet. And so we did a randomized clinical trial years ago showing that people who were just getting the light treatment by themselves healed at a certain rate. Their skin cleared at a certain rate. If they were meditating, their skin cleared at four times that rate. So that is that is really interesting. Something going on in the mind is translating down to the level of gene expression and cell replication in the epidermis. And that's important for a number of reasons. First, because, wow, I mean, that's pretty amazing that you can have that level of control and influence over something as fundamental as gene expression and cell replication. But also, psoriasis has kissing cousin genes, as I sometimes put it, with basal cell carcinoma. So maybe we need to do a study with people with basal cell carcinoma and see whether actually how you train the mind to be in relationship with the skin might make a difference in that outcome. But there are many, to get to the heart of your question, there are many chronic pain conditions, many different chronic medical conditions where people wind up at a place where there's nothing more, the doctors will say, there's nothing more that we can do for you. We are giving you the absolute best of our treatments. And now they're developing, you know, specific genetic treatments for all sorts of different kinds of illnesses so that it's personalized medicine. And they're beginning to realize something that we've been talking about for 40 years, which is, yeah, and medicine also needs to be participatory. You need to get the person who is used to be called the patient engaged in these self-regulatory practices that transform the brain, that transform the genome, that transform the telomeres and so forth, as a complement to whatever the drugs and surgery and other classical, you know, more traditional medical treatments will be. And without that partnership between the patient and the rest of the healthcare team, you really don't have an optimal system for healing. And, you know, there are very few cures in medicine, but beautifully in English, we have the ability to distinguish between curing and healing. And while cures, there are very few of them in medicine, healing is something that's always possible, even if you're a day away from dying. How you are in relationship to it, and my working definition of healing is that it's coming to terms with things as they are. It turns out that there are probably all sorts of biological and genetic and brain mechanisms behind that coming to terms that actually transform the illness itself.
Are there any possible negative effects of mindfulness meditation and mindfulness training?
Yeah, it's important to ask that question. I think the biggest negative effect, so to speak, would be that you run into mental states that you really don't want to pay any attention to, like boredom, for instance, or anxiety or panic or things like that, because you're going to basically be embracing and welcoming any and every state of mind and body to arise. So if you don't want to put the welcome mat out for your anxiety or your boredom or your irritation.
Let's take an extreme example. PTSD.
Yeah.
Someone who has experienced severe trauma, meditation has been proposed as one way of treating PTSD, but could it actually make it worse
by
bringing
absolutely.
It back to the surface?
It can. And this is where the quality of the teaching really comes in and the quality of the environment in which it is taught. So the people doing this have to be very skilled and very much professionals in understanding PTSD and those kinds of chronic stress-related conditions and the level of, the effect that trauma can have on your ability to feel comfortable in your own skin, to feel comfortable in your own body, to trust that there's more right with you than wrong with you when all you're thinking about focusing on is what's wrong with you. So this has to be done very skillfully, and I don't think we can answer your question fully yet. I think that a lot of it has to do, probably there are quite a few people for whom this is not probably the best thing, mindfulness approach, but it could be useful as an ancillary approach to other forms of it because it's ultimately about befriending yourself. And who wouldn't need that, whether you have been traumatized or not? And in terms of trauma, I like to say that no matter how traumatized we are, there's always a part of us that's deeper than that, that's not traumatized, hasn't been traumatized, almost as if, like, no matter how many scars we have, there's always something whole that's holding the scarring. And so if you can touch that in a way that doesn't trigger all the traumatic flashbacks and and that kind of stuff, or creates a container for holding it where it can be worked with and learned from, then mindfulness may have a very big role to play in those kinds of things. But it depends on the quality of the professionals who are doing the work and how deep their own practice is and how human they are in terms of their ability to recognize the suffering in others and allow them to move through that trajectory towards healing at their own pace rather than the pace that you're setting for them.
That's mindfulness expert Jon Kabat-Zinn. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. In 1979, when Jon Kabat-Zinn founded the Stress Reduction Clinic at UMass Medical School and started teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction, there were no scientific studies about mindfulness. As of 2014, there were almost 800. Jon, a lot of the early studies, and you touched on this very earlier in our conversation, focused on what people reported their experience to be, how they reported they felt after meditating.
Self-report studies.
Right, self-reported. Yeah. And now we're getting to this point, as you've said, where we're measuring all of these different genes and molecules in the body and beginning to understand this perhaps in a more rigorously scientific way. Do you think that's really advancing what we understand about how meditation works and how it might be applied in a medical setting?
I do, very much so. But I think that we have to balance our understanding of what we might call the science of mindfulness, which, again, I keep saying, is in its infancy. And the reason I say that is because it is. So even though, yes, you're right, there are like all those hundreds, over 600 or 700 studies this in 2015 on mindfulness, and some of them really good, rigorous, out of very reputable labs and in top-tier journals, published in top-tier journals, it's also really, truly in its infancy. And a lot of it may be sort of not top-of-the-line research. And so this is something that's going to require decades to work out.
What do you see as some of the really important questions about mindfulness that we haven't addressed yet in a scientific way?
Well, what people are trying to do is drill down to the mechanism. Mindfulness seems to be beneficial on so many different levels. It's like, how can that be? Is it just magic? Why is it every time we look at anything?
Well, I mean, mind over body has this,
heart,
you know,
yeah.
it has the aura of magic.
It does. But now we need to, in order for us to not get into, you know, crystal gazing and that kind of thing, to actually, you know, put a foundation under it. And science is a kind of rigorous undertaking. And you have to ask very difficult questions and be your own, you know, harshest critic, so to speak, of your own data and so forth. So it takes decades for that to really unfold. But that said, what I was saying is that as the science develops, we also have to recognize the art of it and that there's a certain kind of beauty to connecting with oneself. My working definition, by the way, which I haven't really said yet about mindfulness, I said that it's awareness. But
right.
It may be helpful for people to understand a more process-oriented sort of operational definition. It's the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally. So paying attention.
Does that have to involve an hour of meditation every day?
No.
Or is that something that, I mean, we were talking about conversations and driving and all of these being exercises
right.
in mindfulness.
Right. But, you know, let me say this on the basis of over 50 years of practicing myself formally by carving out real time on the clock to actually practice formal meditation, sitting or lying down. You can do it in virtually any posture. But again, it's not a doing, it's a being. Is that we need both. We need what we call formal practice to exercise the muscle. And then we also need to bring it out into everyday life so that we finally come to realize that every moment is a moment of mindfulness. And when you just say, oh yeah, I know, I just be here now, I'm just going to be in my body, it won't last very long. So, you know, you need both to be able to handle that. So I'm trying to sort of drill down to the essence of your question.
Well, I guess I wonder, we got a great email here, which I think goes to some of this. And it's the question is, are people born with a busy, distracted, quote unquote, monkey mind? Or is it something that we learn as we grow? Is this a muscle that is strong in all of us when we're born and we are somehow losing it? Or is this really something that we all need to work on?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to answer that. I think the answer is both. If you look at children, they are very present. They learn to walk before they learn to think. So when they fall down, you know, in the process of learning how to walk, they don't feel so criticized by other people because they're laughing at them or think they're cute or whatever, that they don't learn to walk because they begin to sort of feel badly about themselves. They just like learn from falling down. Gravity becomes the teacher and you learn to walk. You don't read a manual on how to walk. So there's a certain way in which, yes, our biology is sort of tilted towards present moment wakefulness. And in the old days when we were running around as hunters and gatherers, I mean, if you got too distracted, you might wind up somebody else's lunch, like a tiger or something like that. So there's an evolutionary pressure, you could say, for present moment wakefulness and not getting lost in thought. On the other hand, as society's gotten more and more complicated, without thinking, you wouldn't be able to navigate a street, you know, or dealing with the complex life that we have. So over time, I think we've drifted away from being in touch with natural rhythms, including our own, and formal meditation practice is a way to regain the being mode as and not just be captured by our driven, doing, thinking mode.
The practices that you teach did come from the Buddhist tradition, but now we have decades of science and this is becoming more of a secular practice. Does mindfulness-based meditation require any faith-based beliefs? Is it in any way tied to religion at this point?
You're asking wonderful questions, and my answer is, you know, again, it's going to be subtle in the sense that it certainly isn't faith-based. It's empirical. That means you try it, you see what the results are. You don't have to have any beliefs whatsoever about this. It's like paying attention. It's like, in a way, that attention that I'm talking about, it's like an orchestra, before it plays Mozart or Beethoven, it tunes its instruments. We don't tune our instruments before we jump out of bed and get out of the house and run around doing all the time. What if we tuned the instrument before we came to work? Would our work be better? Would our relationships be better? If we were students in school and we learned how to tune the instrument of learning, would our learning be better? There's nothing Buddhist or religious about paying attention or the awareness or the sense of deep interconnectedness that comes out of it, and therefore a sense of kindness is like a core element of humanity. Even studies of babies show that they prefer, you know, sort of graphics that demonstrate kindness as opposed to graphics that demonstrate harshness or, you know, sort of emotional cruelty. Babies 6 months old will prefer one to the other by, you know, just enormous differences. So I think that ultimately it's not about religion at all. It's about our deep connectedness with ourselves as human beings. And so I tend to avoid, say, even the word spiritual in terms of meditation, like, oh, it's a meditation. Of course, that's a spiritual practice all religions have and so forth. My working definition of spiritual is really what it means to be fully human. So in that sense, we're discovering that there are, and I don't use the word secular either, because I use the word mainstream instead, because when we talk about secular, then we're excluding what you might call the sacred. And the sacred is a very important part of mindfulness because every moment is in fact sacred. And in medicine, the Hippocratic Oath, the doctor-patient relationship, spoken of as sacred. In the Declaration of Independence, it's our to which we dedicate our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. They're not talking about religion. They're not talking about belief. They're not talking about faith. They're talking about the sort of essential elements of humanity. So I think that as mindfulness moves more into the mainstream, it's stretching all of our envelopes on the religious side, on the science side, on the artistic side, and we're discovering new levels of what it means to be truly human. And just in the nick of time, I would say, because there are many things that humans are doing on the planet that are not healthy for the planet, as you know, and they're not healthy for human life on the planet either. Witness all of the huge migrations that are going on and the forces that those are generating in all of our various societies. And some of those forces are, you know, really beautiful and for the good, but others are actually quite scary and understandably, you know, scary. But nevertheless, what's going to happen on this planet, you know, with everything that's going on with global warming and potential rise of the oceans and so forth? We need the human mind to be at 100% capacity. And we haven't yet figured out as a species how to be at 100% capacity. We call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens, the species that knows and knows that it knows, or awareness and meta-awareness. And I think the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years, if we have that long, we need to really live into it, every single one of us, regardless of belief system, religious tradition, attachment to science, or whatever, to sort of get beyond all our attachments and really be open, spacious, and as intelligent on multiple levels as we can be.
People have, experts in the field, have taken to calling this the century of the brain, the century when we may have the technology and the knowledge to start really unlocking the secrets of the brain and how it works. Where do you see mindfulness in all of that? Do you think that's a key part of understanding how the brain works?
I do. And I think that for the first time, we're seeing scientists in conversation with contemplatives, with people who have been devoting their entire lives to meditation practice, and then writing papers collaboratively together, bringing monastics into the laboratory and studying them with fMRI and other methodologies, which my friend and colleague Richard Davidson does at the University of Wisconsin. You know, and it's quite... This is happening in many, many different places. So I think that there is an evolution going on here, and it's very, very exciting. And it, I think it has tremendous potential for us to, in some sense, reboot ourselves as a species at this particular moment and go for the beauty and recognize our own potential for violence and for horror and tilt things in the direction of optimizing well-being, which is what healing and health are all about, on a global level as well as on an individual medical level, and minimizing the harm that we are all capable of generating when we contract, when we get into fear modes, without learning how to be in wiser relationship with our own, what the Dalai Lama calls destructive emotions.
We have about a minute and a half left. Could you give listeners who might be interested in getting started with mindfulness or advancing their mindfulness practice some ideas of how to get started and resources for the practice?
Yeah, I would say in terms of getting started, just because this is an audio medium, when you're really listening to what's being said or to the sounds of nature, that's the cultivation of mindfulness. Deep hearing. Hearing what's here to be heard without judging it, but just taking it in and apprehending it in its fullness, that's already the practice. So in terms of like easy doorways in or relatively easy doorways in, one is to kind of remember that you're alive. One way to do that, because a lot of times we go on autopilot. Well, the way to do it is to get in touch with your breathing, for instance. And because we're always breathing, as they say, you can't leave home without it. But how much do we take it for granted? We like never pay attention to our breathing unless we have a cold or choking or something like that. So if you learn to actually put your attention someplace in your body where the breath sensations are really prominent, and then you ride on the waves of your breathing, that's one door into it.
That's Jon Kabat-Zinn. He's the creator of mindfulness-based stress reduction and an expert in mindfulness. Jon, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.